Front matter. A treasure hunt in a small town. John W. Partington. Published by John W. Partington. Copyright 2024 John W. Partington. Cover art copyright https://www.123rf.com/profile_zdencam. ISBN 978-1-989973-70-7. Advisory. If you're listening to this book and did not purchase it, or it was not purchased for your use, then consider making a donation to some of the cost of production and encourage future audiobooks. Thank you for respecting the work of this author. Dedication. To my wife, who is not a fictional person, but is smart, kind, and dirt sexy. Acknowledgements. I would like to thank my editing team, Lori Holloway and Jerry Kroll. They did a great job in saving me from many, many errors. If you find any errors, it wasn't from lack of effort on their part. Chapter 1. The Quest. It all starts with a fishing derby in 1979. My dad was quite the angler in his youth and won the Richmond All Ages Fish Derby on the mighty Jock River. First prize was $1,000. $1,000 in the 1970s would be worth about $10,000 by today's standards. To give you an idea, front row tickets to a major concert in Madison Square Garden were about $10 in 1979. People always asked my dad, as the story was related to me because I wasn't even a glimmer in his eye at that point, what he was going to do with his windfall. "I'm going to buy apples," he'd answer. People thought he was a fool, or a lunatic, or both. Flash forward to today, and me hunched over his grave as mourners all wander away after the service. I'm picking up condoms that fell out of a box handed to me by the funeral director. An envelope containing faded pages fell out with the condoms. I open it and read the first page. It's dated at the beginning of September 1979. Dear Ryan, thank you for investing in my company. I'll be sending your stock by separate service once we go public, but I just wanted to welcome you to the family. It's my dream that there be an Apple in every house in America one day, and then the world. Your $1,000 is going to make it happen. You're taking a risk, but I think we're going to do something great together. Steve. What's up? Peter asks as I pore over the letter. We're going on a scavenger hunt, I answer as I look at a clue scrawled on the page. The kids will be happy. What are we looking for? Peter asks. Buried treasure. $1,000 worth of bearer bonds from day one of Apple going public, I say. Excuse me, Peter asks. It turns out, I whisper, even though there's nobody left to hear me, my dad and Steve Jobs were friends. Dad got issued bonds for Apple and has hidden them somewhere. Like a safety deposit box, Peter asks. When did my dad ever use a bank? I think back on my childhood and don't recall my dad ever using a credit card or having an ATM card. He paid cash for everything. How much stock are we talking about? Peter asks. $1,000 worth. I see Peter do some mental math in that geek way that investors do. That's worth about $9 million today, he announces. Sure, I hiss. How do we find this mystery money, he asks. It starts with a brick. Let's go to Mom's house, I answer. The house is sold, Jess. We can't go there anymore, he says. I'll figure something out along the way. Let's just go to the house, I plead. Richmond was a small village, really it still is, but it's getting bigger. There are housing developments going up on the outskirts of town that used to be farmers' fields. The infrastructure of the town, however, is not growing with the population boom. We have one grocery store and two gas stations, a fire hall, but no police station or nearby hospital service. Everything we really need comes from the big city, to which we are only a borough, even though we fiercely defend our independence. Until we need a cop or an ambulance. My mom's house is in the old part of Richmond off McBean Street north of the river that divides the town into two sections. There is one bridge over the river in the center of town, and it's been there forever. It was updated a couple of years ago, but the resurfacing took a long time and ticked a lot of people off. The bridge was down to one lane with a temporary stoplight that nobody seemed to understand. At least, nobody when my signal was green and the opposing traffic didn't want to wait. We get to the house and I knock on the door. Cheryl Truman opens the door. Mrs. Truman is about the same age my mom was and was one of my mom's friends. I think she bought the house in order to find the safe with the fancy shoes. The safe was a loose floorboard under the bed, and I had the Louboutin pumps. I neglected to mention that when I sold the house because that was driving the price. I had yet to wear the shoes in public. Jessica, dear, Mrs. Truman starts. Is there something wrong? I'm sorry I couldn't make it to your father's service, but my back couldn't take the stairs this morning. I understand, Mrs. Truman. I smile. Could we come in? I think there's something I forgot, belonging to my dad, in the basement. It has sentimental value, but no real worth. It wouldn't be a pair of shoes, would it? She asks.
No, I giggle.
I'm not up for company right now, she says. Maybe you could come back tomorrow afternoon, which, in my mind, means she's going to toss the basement looking for whatever she can find. Let her. She'll never wedge her fat bottom behind the furnace.
Of course, I answer.
It's one of his favorite tools. I think it was in an old drawer. The workshop in the basement has dozens of drawers built into the cabinets, and they all stick. Some even need a crowbar to open. She'll be at it for hours if she doesn't give up first.
That was a bust, Peter says as we get into the car.
Brie bubbles spit in her sleep.
We're going back tonight after the old woman is asleep, I announce as Peter puts the car in gear.
That's brake and enter Jess, he says. I'd rather not be an accomplice to a felony.
Not you and I, Chet and I announce.
Me, Chet says as he looks up from a comic book for the first time.
It wasn't me. Nobody can prove I was there. You're not in trouble, Chet, I answer. I need your help tonight.
What are we doing? Chet asks.
B and E, I answer.
Cool. Chet purses his lips. I can't say that planning a break and enter with my 12-year-old son was the high point of my parenting, but neither was it the lowest I had ever sunk. It's above my limited career as a prostitute and telling my in-laws to screw themselves. Only I didn't say it that politely. In the annals of my life, plotting a minor felony with my underage son was somewhere between being the worst parent ever and being the coolest parent ever.
That night I wear black jeans and a long-sleeved black shirt. Chet does the same. We wait until it was dark out and well past time for Chet to be in bed on a school night.
I drive us over to the block beside my mom's house and then park the car. We start to walk stealthily up the block carrying a small backpack full of thieving tools. Those tools are a couple of flashlights and a bottle of water. Jessica Silver, is that you? A voice calls when we are two doors from our destination. It's the McPhersons walking their dog on the opposite side of the street.
Yes, I say weakly.
It's been ages, Mrs. McPherson says.
What are you two doing out this late?
You know, getting in our steps. Chet is my workout buddy.
Well, you picked a bad outfit to wear, Mr. McPherson says. Half the streetlights are out. Black isn't a good choice.
It's wicking material, I say in an even weaker voice.
Dear, we're almost home. We live across from Mrs. Truman. You can take our reflective vests. That way you'll be safer, Mrs. McPherson says. We can't, I start. We insist. You can return them tomorrow. Seriously, it would wound us to find out you and Chet got hit by a pickup truck because the driver didn't see you. At that point, their dog, Puddles, starts to bark and a few porch lights come on. There's nothing more annoying than a dog barking late at night. Okay, I agree, just to get the couple moving again. We walk the short distance to their house, exchange the vests, and then they go inside while Chet and I walk up the street in reflective armor. Now what? Chet asks when we reach the end of the street. Give me your vest, I answer, and then shove them into the backpack. We loop around the block until we're the next street over and opposite Mom's house, the Truman House. I have to stop thinking of it as belonging to Mom. All we have to do is walk to the house from the back neighbor's place. I've heard it said good fences make good neighbors. My mom didn't believe in that philosophy, but her back neighbors did. Help me get up, I order Chet. Mom, we don't have to do this, he answers. Chet, please. This is important. He forms a cup with his hands, I put my foot in, and he staggers under my weight as he lifts with all his might. I just barely manage to reach the top of the 7-foot fence with my hands. I pull and hook one elbow over, and then the other one up. I swing up and hook an ankle. I remember having to do this sort of silly thing in gym class back in high school. I didn't like it then, and I certainly don't like it now. I manage to tilt up and over, and then plummet down the other side. I land with a soft thud on my rump, my dignity hurt more, but still winded. I take a moment. Chet, you need my help, I whisper once I've caught my breath. No, he whispers back from beside me. I use the gate instead. The gate, I hiss. I look to see where he's pointing. I tried to tell you, but you said it was important to climb over the fence. I thought you were trying to prove something. Let's go, I table the conversation. We sneak up to the back of the Target house. How do we get in? Chet asks. My old escape route, I answer. The side basement window, right under the kitchen, never locked properly, and I doubt anybody has fixed it. I sold the house, and I know it was the last thing on my mind. Luckily, there are some shrubs around the side of the house, so we have a bit of cover. I had used the window to sneak out all through my high school years. Looking back, I doubt it was actually sneaking because my dad stored a 5-foot ladder right under that window. A tear wells up for a second. They must have known I was sneaking out and trusted me. I decided I would be more trusting with my children right after committing a robbery with my son. You first, I tell Chet. There could be spiders, Chet says. You're not afraid of spiders, I say. It's not me I'm worried about. If you go in there and freak, we'll get caught, he says. I'm not going to freak. You first. I shine a flashlight beam into the basement to make sure he won't get hurt. He drops in, feet first, like a pro. I back in and get stuck for a fraction of a second as my butt chafes on the narrow window, but then I feel a tug on my legs. I slide the rest of the way in and land on my feet. I hand Chet the flashlight and pull out the second one. I take a sip of water. I turn around to go to the furnace and walk face first into a batch of spider webs. I start to freak out. I'm about to scream when Chet jabs me in the stomach. Instead of screaming, I suck air and spider web into my mouth, but I don't scream. I hate spiders. I look around. The place is a shambles. It looks like Cheryl Truman threw everything she owned down into the basement and then forgot it. There are piles of junk and boxes everywhere. The built-in workbench has half the drawers open. The other half are still shut, and there's a small crowbar lying on the floor. I take a step toward the furnace and hear a hissing scream. Sassafras, is that you in the basement? Cheryl calls from the floor above. The cat I just stepped on meows loudly. All right, cat, I'll leave the door open, but don't be too long. We have to go through the rest of those drawers before that trollop comes over tomorrow. Mom, what's a trollop? Chet whispers. It's like a troll doll, I answer through gritted teeth. I go over to the furnace and ease my way behind it while doing some deep breathing exercises to calm myself. I break away the cobwebs with my flashlight until it's a dim gray light because it's so wrapped in silk. I start counting bricks while Chet stands lookout. I go over 6 bricks and down 4. I try the brick I think is the right one, and it comes out. I shine my light in, dim as it is, and see a small recess. Inside is a small metal box no bigger than a tin of breath mints. I grab the box and shove it in my pocket. "Let's go," I whisper and point back to the window. "You first." Chet scrambles up to the window like a spider monkey by using a stack of plastic tubs beside the opening. He worms outside and then holds the window open for me. I, less gracefully, manage to get halfway up to the window when Chet grabs my hands and starts to pull me out. My ass gets stuck around the frame. I don't eat that much ice cream, but still, I'm not in high school anymore. "Pull," I say as I kick my legs to find a purchase. Chet pulls, I slide painfully along my belly, my foot hits a tub, there's a loud crash and then a cat scream. We run in a crouch along the backyard, out the neighbor's gate, around the block and back to the car. We get in and pull away from the curb. "You can't tell anybody about this," I say to Chet. "Mom, I'm 12, not stupid," he answers. "Do you think I want to end up in juvie?" "Right. You kept your head and did really good," I compliment him. "Thanks," he smiles. "Have you done that before?" I ask. "You can't prove I was there. Nobody saw. It wasn't me. We head home. Already my body is starting to feel the ache from sliding through windows and going over fences. "How did it go?" Peter asks from the bed as I put on a nightgown. "Piece of cake," I answer. "Now I'm thinking about cake." "You know," he strokes my arm while smiling a wolf-like grin, "you're a criminal now. A wanted felon. That's kind of sexy. I could turn you in for a reward." "Really?" I ask. He wiggles his eyebrows suggestively. Actually, he just raises them up and down rapidly in a way he thinks is suggestive, and probably would be if he did it properly, but on him it looks kind of goofy. However, I get his meaning. "Then I suppose I should bribe you for your silence." Chapter 2. The First Clue. The next morning I'm up early enough that I could inspect the box I pilfered, but there's breakfast to be made. More importantly, there's nosy children. Bree is good, she won't squeal, but she's not yet even a year old. Ariel can certainly keep her silence if her robbing a grave with my father proved anything. Chet couldn't keep a secret even if he was given a court injunction. "Hey Mom, what is in the box?" Chet saunters into the kitchen as I was thinking about how to deal with the secret. "It's empty," I lie. I figure that's the best way to deal with Chet. If he has no excitement in the outcome, he won't bother telling anybody a boring story about robbing a house with his mother in the dead of night. I figure my chances were 50-50 on him keeping silent. "Really?" he asks. "Yep," I mumble as I pour some cereal. "We went through all that trouble and got an empty box," he exclaims. "Yep," I lie to my son, again. Maybe Grandpa never got that far in his plot before moving into the old age home. Maybe Chet agrees. What a waste. We finally get to do something cool, and it's no good. "Chet, breaking into an old woman's house and robbing her is not cool," I scold. "You and I will both have to go to confession for this." "What's confession?" he asks. "That's where you tell a priest your sins," I answer. "He makes you do some prayers for penance, and then you're forgiven. It's a Catholic thing." "Are we Catholic?" Chet asks. "Yes, occasionally," I answer. "Can we skip the praying and then go right to forgiveness?" he asks. "That's a God thing, right? Do we believe in God? I mean, we buried Granny and Grandpa in a cemetery, but I don't remember ever going to church." "We belong to a church," I said. Which one? Chet asks. The big one on the other side of town. What's on the other side of town? Ariel comes into the kitchen and sits at the table. The church we belong to, Chet answers. We belong to a church, Ariel has a second question. Of course we belong to a church, I say. Why? They both ask at the same time. What do you mean? Why, it's church, I say. But why do we belong, Ariel asks. Do they do anything for us, Chet asks. Is it like a secret club we belong to but have never been to because the meetings are mysterious? It's church. We're going this Sunday, I say. We're going where? Peter comes into the kitchen dressed for work. He gives me a peck on the cheek as he grabs a coffee. We're going to church and confess our sins, Chet answers. It's a secret club, Ariel adds commentary. Are we being punished? Peter asks. It's church, I say again through gritted teeth. It would do us all some good to be reminded of things that are more important. More important than our education, Ariel asks. Well, no, I admit. More important than being a good person, Chet asks. Not exactly, I say. More important than sleeping in on Sunday, Peter questions. Yes, certainly. Church is more important than sleeping in, I answer. How early do we have to get up? Chet asks. I don't know, I answer. I'll find out when the service is. Sounds like a punishment, Peter mumbles around a mouth full of cereal. George and I were going to play golf on Sunday. After church, I say. This Sunday we're having a family outing. Yay! The kids cry. To church, I continue. We will behave, my eyes linger on Chet, and I pause, be better people for it. Better than what? Chet asks. Non-churchgoers, Ariel answers. That's what we are now. I like what we are now, Chet says. Me too, Peter agrees. Church is not a punishment, I say. If you continue to act this way, it will be. So, if we go to church, we're not being punished. Chet starts slowly as he reasons through the logic, unless it's a punishment. In which case we'll go to church. Jess, can I be excused? Peter asks. Yes, dear. Just put your bowl in the dishwasher, I answer. No. I mean from church, not the table. I'd rather get a good amount of rest before hitting the links, my husband says. I have homework, Chet says. It's not a punishment. I yell. We're all going to church this Sunday, and if anybody misbehaves, we'll go again. I shove some cereal into my mouth and decide the argument is settled. Nobody makes eye contact, and then the kids leave to catch the bus for school. Peter kisses me on the forehead as I grind cereal through my teeth. He leaves for work. I am alone, finally. I put away the dishes before slipping the tin box out of the pocket of my dress. I have a dress with pockets. Specifically, one dress with pockets. Men always ask how to make women happy. Design more clothing with functional pockets instead of clothes that make our ass and boobs look good. Seriously. Carrying a purse everywhere is a burden and exhausting. I pour a cup of coffee and sit at the table. Inside the tin is a small rusty key and a hand-scrawled note. It's a riddle. I have two young children and a baby. I hate riddles. Every day Chet asks me what I'll get when I cross some animal with some appliance. I really hate riddles, but for $9 million I'll put my prejudice aside. If you're reading this, I am dead. I read the note out loud. My treasure rests among the bread. Donuts, crumpets, many cakes. Things indulged make your belly ache. Don't look low, but look high, near the ducks above the pie. There are two floors. The first has none. The lock is beneath the bung. I pause for a sip of coffee. The old bakery building.
The treasure was buried or housed in the old bakery. The bakery itself closed a few years ago and is now occupied by Danby's Roadhouse Restaurant. It is a family restaurant with good food at reasonable prices. I don't think I can go in there and ask if they have $9 million in bonds lying around unclaimed. I need to go in person and have a diversion. Chet excels at diversions, but then he would know I lied to him. I pick up the phone and dial a number from the local yellow pages. The book isn't an official phone book. It is mostly local advertising with a few numbers to find local services. It has the phone number I am looking for. A woman answers the phone, Danby's Roadhouse. This is Deb.
Hi Deb, I start. This is Jessica Silver. Can I get a table for tonight?
Jess, it's 8:30 in the morning. We don't even open for 3 hours.
Then why did you pick up the phone, I ask.
I thought you were a supplier, Deb answers. I'm expecting a shipment this morning. They keep changing drivers, so they get lost sometimes.
Oh! Can I have a table, I ask again.
The computer is not even on yet, Deb answers. I'll make a note. What time? I don't want the whole family there, but I have to find a babysitter if it's just me and Peter, so on a Thursday night it can't be that late as all the responsible teenagers will want to be home early to finish schoolwork and get to bed for classes on Friday. I think. That's what I would do back when I was in high school, if I recall correctly. 7:30, I answer as the other thoughts flash through my head. I'll have to find a babysitter.
Okay, Deb answers.
There's a call on call waiting.
That's probably the truck.
Got to go, see you at 7:30.
Thanks, bye, I hang up.
There's a knock at the front door.
I go to answer it.
Standing at the door is a woman, wearing the same dress I am, but wearing it better. Her makeup is ruined by the 5 o'clock shadow on the chin and throat.
Today, Jock is a woman.
Coffee, ma sherry. She holds out a cup from the local coffee shop.
Thank you, I take the coffee. I don't really want it, but Jock is one of the more tolerant friends I have.
She doesn't get upset by anything, and when she's a man, he doesn't get upset by anything. You look worried, she says. Tell me about it.
I am all ears and eyes and a mouth and an incredible ass.
What's wrong, Ma Sherry?
I'm surprising Peter with dinner out tonight, I answer.
And you need money to finance this endeavor, Jock guesses.
No. I need a babysitter to watch the kids, including Bree, I say.
You're in luck. It just so happens my social calendar is free tonight, and I excel at entertaining children, he smiles.
That's nice, but they can be a handful, I say diplomatically.
Somehow, though he's never said anything about it, Peter might not react well to my transvestite friend babysitting our impressionable children.
Chet, in particular, might cause problems, I finish.
Jessica, when have I ever steered you wrong or been anything other than the paragon of dignity and composure? When you were charged with soliciting, I provided testimony proving your innocence. When we investigated your mother's grave robbing, I was tactful.
We are friends. Friends help each other. It would be an honor to sit on your babies.
Okay, I giggle. You do know that you don't actually sit on them.
Of course. It was a turn of phrase to make you smile.
When do you want me here? Jock asks.
7 o'clock, I answer.
How to put this tactfully, at which I excel.
What gender do you want me to be? She asks.
You just be you, I smile. It's already going to be an interesting evening. I don't think there's anything Jock could do to make it more interesting no matter what she wore.
We talk for about half an hour, and then she leaves.
Around noon, I start walking over to Cheryl Truman's house, my mom's house. There's no reason for me to go, but it might arouse her suspicion if I don't. It's not a long walk, but I'll certainly reach my step goal for the day as a result. It's a good afternoon for a walk.
The weather is warm, summer is about to hit, and the sun is bright. I take my purse and put on running shoes. I don't actually run, but running shoes are more comfortable for a walk than heels. I learned that the hard way. I pass by people walking their dogs and make occasional small talk. Richmond is a friendly town, for the most part. I'm sure we've got our bad apples like any place else, but I've never met one. I get to Mom's house faster than I intended. I walk up the step and ring my old doorbell. Jessica, dear, Mrs. Truman opens the door. I wasn't sure you would be by. I was in the area on my walk and remembered, I answered. Well, you might as well come in. She opens the door wide. An orange tabby bolts out the door. Sassafras. Will he be all right? I ask. I'm more concerned about the cat than the old woman climbing downstairs to watch me plunder. It's not him I'm worried about. Do you hear the songbirds? She asks. No, I answer after cocking my ear. There's silence in the neighborhood. He's the reason why. The mice in the basement aren't challenging enough for him, so he's after bigger game. I try to keep him inside, but he's the scourge of the neighborhood. Come in, dear. Let's go find your treasure. That's an odd choice of words, but I let it pass. I don't think Cheryl Truman could know about the treasure, but she could be using me to scout it out. I realize that is a paranoid thought, but with $9 million at stake, it pays to be cautious. Keep your shoes on, she says as I step in. We go to the basement. It's even more of a shambles than the night before. She's been busy this morning. There is a pile of tubs lying all over the floor near the window. Broken Christmas ornaments and shattered glass are everywhere. None of the stuff in the basement is my family's, other than the contents of some of the workshop drawers. Between the search for expensive shoes and missing jewels, the house had been picked clean by friends and neighbors. Some of the drawers are stuck, so we didn't get to them all in the house cleaning. What are you looking for? Mrs. Truman asks. It's my father's favorite tool, I answer as I walk over to the built-in tool bench. It has shelves reaching all the way to the low ceiling. I grab a drawer near the top and give it a tug. It slides out reluctantly, and I grab the first thing I can find. What is that? Cheryl asks. It's an egg vibrator. I hold a wand-like tool with a cord trailing off the end to a small, odd-shaped ball. A what? She asks. A sex toy. It was my dad's favorite vibrator. He used it on various clients as he did small jobs around the village. Were you ever one of his jobs? I most certainly was not, she says in shock. I think it's probably mock shock because I know for a fact my dad laid the floor at her old house. He was a horn dog, so probably laid her at the same time. Wanna give it a try? I hold the wand toward her. It's Garden of Eden. It's a good brand, though I suppose the batteries might be dead. I press a button and the egg at the end of the tether vibrates to life. Maybe not. Take your depravity and leave, she says, while eyeing the top drawer. I go up the stairs, followed by Mrs. Truman. What are you planning to do with that? She points at the vibrator when we get to the front door. I'm going to clean it, I answer. And then maybe mount it on a plaque over my fireplace. It's really nothing more than a conversation piece. Peter gets home from work and starts to jerk his tie off. It looks like it's been a bad day. Normally he's composed, kisses me hello, and then takes off his tie. Bad day, I ask. I already know it is, but if he wants to talk, this seems the best way to start. Cliff is selling the company, Peter says in a defeated voice. I've worked there 15 years and moved nowhere. I'm a valuable asset, but any new CEO is likely to bring in their own staff. I'll probably be out of a job in a month after the sale goes through. But if you're a valuable asset, I start. I know where all the bodies are buried and a new owner is going to have their own way of doing things. I'm an asset to Cliff. A liability to anybody else. If we ever needed a windfall, it would be now. Speaking of which, we're having dinner at Danby's tonight, I say. How is that a windfall? Peter asks.
It's where the bonds are hidden. On the second floor. I need you to cause a distraction while I go upstairs and solve the clue. I've got it almost worked out. I don't know what a bung is, other than a bunghole, and I don't think that's the same thing.
A bung is the plug they use to stopper whiskey barrels, Peter says, like it's the most common thing in the world. I look at him. George and I got the news from Cliff at a swank restaurant that had its own distillery. We got a crash course in whiskey tasting.
So you're drunk, I ask.
No, I didn't have that much. I had to drive home, but if you can drive tonight, I'd like to get toasted because it's been a shitty day all around. Did you manage to find a babysitter, or are we leaving Chet in charge? He asks.
I like my children, I laugh. I have a friend coming over to sit. Chet could handle sitting Ariel, but I think Bree is too much.
Agreed. Who is coming? Peter says.
I don't actually know, I admit.
Do you know when they are coming? He asks.
7 o'clock, I answer.
But you don't know who, he clarifies.
It could be one of two people, I say.
What kind of distraction do I have to cause? Peter asks.
One that will let me slip up to the second floor. I don't care how you do it, but I need to get up there.
At 7 o'clock, the doorbell rings. Chet races to get it. I don't know what to expect, but I told the kids a friend was coming over to sit.
Mom, there's a man in a skirt here, Chet shouts.
Great, my son is tactless and insensitive. The last thing I want is to offend my friend while trying to amend my son's gender confusion. I get to the front room, and there is Jock wearing a suit with a blue and white tartan skirt.
It is a kilt, mon petit ami, Jock laughs. It is the colors of my family tartan on my Scottish side. We don't talk about them much. They are the sheep of the family.
The black sheep, I ask.
No, the blue and white sheep, Jock says.
Mom, Chet eyes Jock suspiciously.
Jock puts a large knapsack by the door.
This is my friend Jock, I say. Chet grins and puts out his hand.
Shake, Chet says. Jock starts to grab Chet's hand, but just as he's about to make contact, he goes into a quivering, convulsive fit like he's having a seizure. Chet jumps back in alarm.
Mom.
I shook, Jock says as he stops quivering.
It's an old joke. Jock puts out his hand.
Chet grabs it a little too eagerly. There's a buzzing noise, and Chet jumps back in alarm a second time.
That hurt, Chet shouts.
It did not hurt. Jock holds up his hand to show the joy buzzer ringed around his finger.
I didn't like it, Chet declares.
But you thought I would, Jock replies. You were eager to buzz me. Not so much fun when the tables are turned, is it?
No, Chet sulks.
I pocketed your joy buzzer when I distracted you with my convulsions, Jock explains. That is your first lesson in sleight of hand. Only let the audience see what you want them to see by distracting them from what they think they know.
Huh, Chet asks, while at the same time I'm thinking the same thing.
Tonight, I'm going to teach you some magic tricks. Jock eyes the knapsack.
Cool, Chet whistles. I'm thinking it will be a while before Chet dates, so learning magic might not be a bad hobby. It'll likely prolong his entry into the dating world.
I don't mind that.
Hey, Jock, you're the sitter. Peter comes into the room.
It is a favor, Jock answers. Your wife has been so kind to me. The least I can do is sit your children while you have dinner at one of the best restaurants in town.
I could sit the kids while you be the distraction, Peter suggests.
Distraction? Jock looks confused.
Oh, I see. Jessica Moss-Sherry, you're up to shenanigans. Do tell.
If I can be of help, I make an excellent distraction.
I want to learn magic, Chet pipes up. How do you know I'm not teaching it now? Jock asks. You're just talking with Mom and Dad, Chet says. But, Jock smiles, you are distracted by this. What have I done that you didn't notice? Nothing, Chet answers. Really? Jock glances to his kilt. It's a red and yellow tartan instead of blue and white. I didn't think I would miss a transvestite changing kilts in my front hall while having a conversation, but there it was. Cool, Chet and Peter whistle at the same time. Teach me that, Chet adds. First you need a kilt, Jock answers. It seems, Jessica, Peter will be your distraction for your shenanigans. Pity. I like a good mischievous adventure. Jock picks up his bag. Come, Chet, let us find your sisters and I'll teach you how to make a baby vanish. Jock, I start. It's a trick, Jock winks. Let Peter show you the layout while I have a word with Chet, I say. Of course, Peter laughs. I just changed Bree and put her to sleep, so she won't likely give you any trouble. I'll show you the baby station. The two men wander upstairs. Chet, I say once the two are out of earshot. I didn't do it, Chet answers. You're not in trouble. Do not tell Jock anything about Grandpa's quest or our break-in, I explain. The box was empty. What would it matter? Chet asks. Crap. I'm caught. The box had a false bottom, I lie yet again. There was a clue that involves Danby's Roadhouse from when it was the bakery. Your dad and I are going to check it out, but it is essential this remain a secret. I can keep a secret, Chet answers. I'm counting on you, I say. I got this, Chet smiles. It's like a dog smiling. It's cute, but I have no idea what is going on inside his skull. I often wonder what it would be like to know what my kids are really thinking. Then I decide I'm probably better off not knowing. We're ready, Peter announces as the men enter the room. Are we walking or driving? We might have to bring something back, I answer. I have no idea how big a package of Von Stocks is. It's probably one slip of paper, or it could be 1,000 slips of paper. Let's roll. Peter picks up the car keys. Chapter 3. The Second Clue. Hey Jess, welcome to Danby's, Deb says when we step into the restaurant. Have you been here for 11 hours, I ask her. Thanks for noticing, Deb yawns while covering her mouth. It's exams, so a lot of the staff booked time off. Christine will be your server. You're at the Capone booth. That's the nicest table in the restaurant. It also happens to be close to the stairs going up to the second floor. All I have to do is skirt the wall and go up the stairs once Peter makes his distraction. I know upstairs is a party room that can be rented out for special occasions. I've never been up there, but I know my dad was involved in the renovations. I can't say what he did, but he was a jack-of-all-trades handyman. I think he did everything but electrical work. We sit in the booth, which is way too big for only two people. The banquette goes three quarters of the way around the round table, with the missing quarter facing the restaurant. The booth is set to the side by the front window in a kind of alcove formed by an interior wall and exterior windows. Basically, I have to go to the edge of the interior wall and up the stairs on the other side. How are you going to cause a distraction? I ask Peter as he asks, how am I going to cause a distraction? Can I start you with drinks? A young woman, maybe a senior in high school, comes over to the table. She's pert and perky, everything I was in high school. I'm a little jealous for a second before remembering that my life is pretty good. If I could go back to high school and do it all over, I wouldn't. If I could spend 5 minutes with my past self, that might change things, but thankfully I am out of that hormone hell until Chet goes into grade 9 next year. Then we'll be sucked back in. A pint of whatever is on draft, Peter says. I'll have a glass of house white, I answer. I'll bring ice water too, Christine, presumably from what Deb said, replies. At least she knows her stuff. Bringing water means we won't get too drunk too fast. The distraction, Peter asks again. We'll have to wait for an opportunity and think of something, I reply as I look at the menu. Opportunity knocks when Christine comes back. She's wobbling slightly under the weight of four drinks on a platter. As she almost gets to the table, my leg appears to spasm and kicks her in the ankle. The drinks and tray come crashing down on Peter's lap. Oh my gosh! Christine cries as she takes a bar towel from behind her apron and starts to dab at Peter's crotch. It's okay. Peter stands up. Christine falls on her knees and resumes wiping his thighs with the rag. Maybe you can show me to the facilities, Peter suggests. Christine looks confused. The bathroom, I offer a translation to her. Right this way, she exclaims and grabs Peter to drag him off. I start to follow, at least as far as the end of the interior wall. Our server is taking Peter down a back hall while all patrons' eyes are on him, chuckling as he follows, looking like a second-grade potty accident. I slip up the stair unseen. I didn't know what to expect upstairs. I guess I expected it to be like a church hall with tables all over the place. Instead, there are comfortable-looking couches and armchairs around coffee tables. It's a lounge. On the neutral-colored walls is a gallery of stuff: clocks, tin stars, bar signs of popular beers, more clocks. I am at a loss. I think I expected a sign reading, insert key here, with a big arrow. I figure I have about 5 minutes. There's no way I'm going to find what I'm looking for without even knowing what I'm looking for. I look to the ceiling, trying to make contact with my dad in heaven, and then I see it. Near the ceiling is a relief of a whiskey barrel. It's small, but certainly a whiskey barrel. I drag one of the coffee tables over to the wall and then stand on it. There's a plug in the picture, a bung. I grab the car keys from my purse and dig the bung out. Underneath there is a keyhole for an old-fashioned key. I put the key from the tin box into the lock, give it a turn, and then the entire front of the relief eases open on a hinge. A manila envelope flutters to the ground. I grab it and stash it in my purse. Voices come from the stairs. I can't quite make out what they're saying. I look around and see a set of back stairs to the lounge. I scamper down them and come out in the hall by the bathrooms. Peter and Christine are walking back to the table about 6 feet in front of me. Wait up, I blurt. They turn around. Where did you come from? Christine asks. Ladies, I point to the bathroom door. That makes sense. Peter stares at me. Yes, it does. Do you want to go home and put on dry clothing? I ask. Yes, please. Maybe we should get a couple of pizzas for takeout. I'd like to eat something for dinner, he says. Christine, can we get a medium combination, a medium pepperoni, and a small cheese to go, please? I order the food. Sure thing. She smiles in relief. A customer is allowed to leave wet and cold, as long as they're satisfied, I suppose. We get home to find the children and Jock in the living room. Jock is off to the side. Bree is asleep in her car seat. Ariel is lying on the floor in a large cardboard box, and Chet is standing over her with a small electric chainsaw. Hey, Mom. Chet looks up in delight as he squeezes the trigger so the chainsaw rips to life. Want to see me cut Ariel in half? Oh my God, I screech. Shush, Jock holds a finger to his lips. You'll wake the babe. The electric chainsaw is very quiet. Shrieking Jessica, not so much. Put that down, I order. Mom, Chet complains. Down, I order. You're no fun. He turns the chainsaw off. You've only been gone 40 minutes, Jock comments as Peter edges past me with the boxes of pizza. I did not think this was takeout. I had planned an eventful extravaganza for your return. This was the finale. Pizza, kids, Peter calls from the kitchen. Ariel hops out of the box, leaving a pair of fake legs poking out the bottom. Is there cheese? She asks as she scampers to the kitchen. Of course there's cheese, Peter answers. There is no blade in the saw. Jock holds the tool out for my inspection. I would not hurt your children. I'm sorry, Jock. I put a reassuring hand on his arm. I didn't explain. We have a house rule about Chet and power tools that dates back to the electric staple gun incident. Nobody got physically hurt then, but it caused a rule to be implemented. He mentioned no such rule when we were talking, Jock says. Chet, I shout. Wasn't me. I hear him mumble around a mouth full of pizza. Do you want to join us for dinner? I ask Jock. Do we get to discuss the treasure you went out to get? Jock asks. Chet, I scowl. Not me, I hear from the kitchen. I walk into the kitchen followed by Jock. You swore you were going to keep that secret, I say. He tricked me, Chet explains. I doubt that, I say. I kind of did, Jock backs up the story. I asked what secret mission you were on tonight, thinking it was a quiet evening away from the children. He would not tell me because it was a secret. Still thinking it was an innocent adventure, I reminded him there could be no secrets between magicians or we would not be able to learn tricks of the trade from each other. And I asked. He spilled like a broken colander. I take it from your early return you are either very successful or woefully disappointed, Jock says. We got the bonds, I answer. Did we? Peter asks. You were there, I reply. I was in the washroom trying to blow dry my pants with the hand dryer while the server fretted like a mother hen. I pull the craft paper envelope out of my purse and drop it on the kitchen table. All eyes stare at it, like it's the last slice of pizza. My stomach growls and knocks us all back to the present. Pizza, I say as I grab a plate and a slice of pepperoni. That can wait until after we eat. I'm starved. We sit around the coffee table in the living room, that being the more dignified place to spill out $9 million. I open the envelope and pull out a piece of letter-sized paper. Excitement floods me as I unfold it to read another clue. Shit, I mutter. Murd, Jock agrees. Let's hear it, Peter suggests while Chet and Ariel eagerly wait. Old man Saunders had a farm, yoki-doki-do. I read. And on his farm, where I lie, I hid a stash in case I die. Take the map in the second envelope, but avoid the maze's trap, hee-hee-ha-ha-ho. And there's a bunch of numbers. Maybe it's the combination of a safe. So let's see the map in the second envelope, Peter suggests. I don't have a second envelope, I confess. It must have gotten stuck in the box lid when it hinged open. So we have to do this again, Peter asks. I didn't exactly shut the box. Someone was coming. It's open. Whoever came in would see the safe hanging open and certainly find the second envelope, I explain. Might I be in for a cut if I get the map? Jock asks. How are you going to do that? I reply. Sleight of hand. I will need the assistance of young Chet. It is almost 9 o'clock. They are only open for another hour. If you want help, we have to move quick. I don't know, Peter pauses. What are we going to do? I ask. Go back there and confess we were robbing the place, but forgot a piece of what we were trying to steal. Go, Jock, take Chet. Be home soon. They leave in a flurry of shoes and jackets. Ariel, bed. But she starts. It's 9 o'clock on a school night the week before summer vacation. Do you really want to start with a grounding? I ask. Chet got to go out, she complains. If we need to dig up a grave, we'll give you a call, Peter smiles at her. Your mom is right. 8 more days and then no school. Go get ready for bed. I never get to do as much as Chut, she complains. Says the diamond thief, I laugh. Bed. I'll come tuck you in as soon as I put Bree back in her crib. Ariel fusses about her bedtime, but usually her head barely hits the pillow before she falls asleep. 40 minutes pass. It's almost 10 o'clock and well past time for Chut to be in bed. I'm considering calling Jock when a car rolls into the driveway. I hear doors slam and then a knock at the front door. I open the door and Chut bounds into the room, completely drenched and covered with ketchup. Jock follows Chut in. What happened, I ask. I was a distraction, Chut answers. A significant distraction, Jock agreed. Chut, go shower and then get in bed, I tell him. But Chut starts to complain. Shower, bed, and don't forget to brush your teeth, I order. I never get to have any fun, he sulks away. What happened? I turn to Jock. A tray of drinks, a young lady named Christine, and some condiments, Jock answers. He will make a wonderful magician if he calms down a bit in order to learn. Did you get the map? Peter yawns. We're normally in bed by this time. Maybe not sleeping, but in bed. I got a map, Jock replies. Even with young Chut, there was a table full of people with a great deal of interest in that piece of paper. I was not able to get the map. He holds up his phone. I got a picture of it. A rather good picture. Let's print it, I almost cry. It takes a second to hook Jock's phone into our house Wi-Fi, and then the printer whirls to life. It shoots out a topographic map of a relatively flat plain with a number of points of interest on it. Without knowing where it is, the map is practically useless. So we don't know where this is, Peter says. We do. I hold up the piece of paper I brought home. Saunders Farm. Ma Sherry, friend Peter, I bid you adieu, Jock smiles. It is late, and we could all use some sleep before the next step in the shenanigans. Good night, Jock. I kiss him on the cheek. You're a good friend. He takes his leave, and then Peter and I get ready for bed. Field trip to Saunders Farm. Peter snuggles under the blanket. Right after church, I reply. I'm supposed to golf with George, he reminds me. I'll take the kids. How hard can it be, I say. Chapter 4, A Complication. The next morning, Friday before the last week of school, I'm waiting for the bus when a neighbor walks by with a shovel and pickaxe. It's a little late in the season to start a garden with there already have been 2 months of the growing season, but then again, maybe he's making a new bed. Then I see a bunch of men walking down the street, all armed with digging equipment. David, I call to one of them. He's from the next street over. What's going on? There's a treasure buried in the park, he answers. What, I ask. Didn't you hear? They found a secret map at Danby's Roadhouse restaurant. It shows where there's millions of dollars hidden in treasure. It's in the park, we think. Got to go, Jess. If I don't dig, I don't get my share. They're digging for our treasure. Chet barely contains his enthusiasm. It's the last few days of school, Mom. We're not going to learn anything. Let's skip and dig up the gold before someone else does. I'm good with a shovel, Ariel agrees. Bree is nestled against my chest in her carrier. She looks up, yawns, scrunches up her face, and then goes back to sleep. My daughter has just dropped a loaf. No, I answer. But Mom, they both say at the same time. Listen, you two, your education is important, and they're digging in the wrong spot. We're going on Sunday after church to recover the treasure. Gossip travels fast in a small town. It's only 8:30 in the morning, and already I see most of my neighbors out on their lawns with shovels. I don't think any of them are interested in flower beds. The park is being destroyed, and who knows where else. What are we going to do without the park? Ariel asks while Chet grins like a maniac. It's going to be a long day. I consider holding Chet back from school, but the bus arrives. Tell nobody anything, I caution the children, but mostly Chet. I give him the mom look. I see my kids onto the bus and then stroll home with Bree. I hope it's going to be a quiet day, but the fates have never been so lucky. It's around noon when I receive a phone call. Jessica Silver, a voice I recognize, asks. Yes, I groan. What has he done now? Jessica, this is Margaret Woods from the school. I know, Margaret. I know your voice. Is he expelled or only suspended? Neither, that I know of. We're sending the children home early. There's been a bear walking around the school. The bus should be arriving shortly. I hear the screech of metal on metal near the intersection. My day is over. The kids burst through the front door. There was a bear, Mom, Ariel says. What are they going to do? Is somebody going to shoot it? There wasn't a bear, Chet adds, finally a voice of reason. It was Bigfoot. I saw him. It was a Sasquatch. Maybe not a voice of reason after all. What happened, I ask. We were out on the playground for morning recess, Ariel explains. Then this big hairy thing came charging out of the woods at the edge of the playground. It growled and screamed, like a bear. I saw it up close, Chad adds. We were trying to skip stones in the creek. It was wearing jeans. It was Bigfoot. Was anybody hurt, I ask. No, they both say. Good. Bears can be dangerous. But it wasn't a bear. It was Bigfoot, Chet stresses. He's probably after our treasure. How do you jump to that conclusion, I ask. Well, it's obvious. He's Bigfoot. He's a monster. Monsters guard treasure, so Dad will have to defeat Bigfoot and we can get the gold. Why can't Mom defeat Bigfoot? Ariel asks. Why does it have to be Dad? Dad's a guy. Guys fight monsters, Chet says. What do women do? I ask. Mostly get in the way, Chet answers. I'm about to school Chet on gender equality when I notice something on the front lawn. Hey, I shout out the door at my neighbors about to start digging up my lawn. Get out of there. Hey, Jess, David answers. The park was a bust, but we're pretty sure the treasure is buried under your grass. We've got a metal detector, and it says there's gold under here. It's stocks, not gold, you idiots, I blurt. Really, they look up. What do you know about it? Do you have some inside information? David asks. No, I recover. If there were $1 billion in gold lying about, do you think we'd only be finding out about it now? David stops digging and then stoops to pick up a slender ring. Gold, he proclaims. Gold-plated, his digging partner adds. Get the fuck off my lawn, I shout. I'll call the cops if I have to. David waves the metal detector over the ground, but there isn't any blip. The committee will be back to ask you some questions. David scowls at me. Great, now I have treasure-hunting vigilantes coming over for tea. I get back inside to find Ariel and Chet still entrenched in their argument over whether it was a bear or Bigfoot. Mom, tell her there are no bears around here, Chet demands. There are bears around here, Chet. Deep in the woods, but they're seen from time to time. See, Ariel uses the ultimate kid logic. Tell Chet there's no such thing as Bigfoot. Chet, I don't want to crush him totally. It was probably a bear, or a guy in a Bigfoot suit, or something. I doubt very much it actually was a Sasquatch. Nobody ever believes me, Chet complains. I believe you saw Bigfoot, I try to console him. That's the same as saying you don't believe. Can I have a sandwich? I suppose having the kids talk about lunch is a step up from Yeti, so I pull out some cold cuts and mustard. Saturday is quiet. One of Peter's nieces or nephews has a birthday party. Given that Peter's family is roughly the size of a National League football team, including the bench warmers, it's likely there's a birthday party any given weekend. I thankfully have been requested not to attend by Peter's mother. The woman can hold a grudge, and maybe telling her to take a stiff one more often wasn't tactful of me, but the advantage is that I don't have as much contact with the old harpy anymore. I decide to tend to my flower beds out front. They're more bed than flower and are littered with weeds. After a quick trip to the local nursery, I've got a flat of annuals. It's sad that they're going to die at the end of the summer, but until then my garden will be kicking. I wear shorts and an old t-shirt so I can get some sun, and then start pulling junk out of the garden and into a paper lawn bag. I am happily minding my own business when a shadow passes over me. I look around to see a group of four men standing close behind me, admiring the view. Is there a problem? I start to stand up. Don't get up. The spokesman pushes my shoulder to knock me back down. What do you want? I demand, a little shaken by the fact that I just got forced back to the ground, but not so shaken I wasn't targeting the guy's nutsack, so when I got up I could hoof him in the balls. We want to talk about the treasure, and it seems to us you know something. I take a look at the men. I don't recognize three of them, but the fourth is David. I don't know anything about a treasure, I lie. Maybe we'll have to take you into the house and beat it out of you. Two things happen simultaneously. He raises his arm like he's going to slap me, and a sports car careens into my driveway with a squeal as the brakes bring it to a halt. A well-appointed man in a business suit gets out. He swaggers over to the group of us. His jaw is clean-shaven and strong. He has an air of confidence. His clothing is immaculately tailored, and he's a little over 3 feet tall. Is there a problem here? Figaro asks. Fuck off, midget, the leader snarls. Jess, Figaro questions. These men are threatening me, I admit. Fig is a kind, gentle soul, but also a champion street fighter in mixed martial arts. He's part of a fight club and, to the best of my knowledge, is undefeated. Right, Fig takes off his jacket and tie, pauses, and then takes off his vest and starts to roll up his sleeves. He's giving the jackasses a chance to back away, and at the same time ensuring there's very little for them to grab hold of on him. His excess clothing is tossed into his car. Fuck off, midget, the leader says again, or we'll beat the shit out of you. Uttering threats is an indictable offense with a 5-year prison term, Fig advises. What are you, a cop? He asks. Better. I'm a lawyer. Now please, I don't want to hurt you, but you have to go and leave my friend alone. There will be consequences if you do not leave and never come back. Fuck you. The spokesman unleashes a foot at Fig's head. Fig pirouettes inside the sweep of his enemy and then punches the leader square in the crotch in an upper hand strike. The man doubles over in front of Fig. Fig leaps into the air in a flying roundhouse kick that collides with the thug's head. The jerk goes down hard. Get him, the bully manages to mutter while lying in a fetal position. The other three rush Fig, though David is a little hesitant. I'd only seen Figaro fight a couple of times, but it's beautiful. He doesn't fight, he dances among his enemies with a surety of foot and grace. It's like watching interpretive dance. Within 5 minutes, the four men are bruised and bloodied, lying on the ground whimpering and begging for mercy. Here's what's going to happen, Figaro says as he starts rolling down his sleeves. He hasn't even broken a sweat. By the end of the day, there will be a restraining order against you four to stay at least 100 yards away from my client. I know a judge who works weekends. You're pretty much fucked. If you approach my client or send a representative with the intention of approaching my client, you'll go to prison for 5 years. He grabs hold of the down leader's jaw and raises him to eye level. I'll ensure you get put in the worst prison in the country, Fig snarls with contained fury. Do you understand? There's the stench of urine as the bully wets himself. I'll take that as a yes. Figaro drops the man. Now the lot of you get out of here before I have to escort you out. They drag their sorry asses out of my yard while Fig strikes a heroic pose that comes to waist height. The four men turn tail and scuttle back where they came from. Hey Jess, Figaro strikes a more conversational tone. I was driving through the neighborhood when I saw this going down. You okay? I'm better now, I admit. Do you want to come in for coffee? It's actual coffee, right? That's not a euphemism, he asks. Men, I say. Hey, I'm still a dude and you're still dirt sexy, but yeah. A coffee would be wonderful. What's going on around here anyway? We go in for coffee, and while I'm brewing the pot, I tell Fig about the incident with the four amigos on my front lawn. Is there any truth in their claim? He asks. Are you asking as a friend or as my lawyer? I reply. I can do two things at the same time, he answers. However, I can't help you if I don't know the truth. You can treat this as lawyer-client privilege if you want. I won't tell anyone else. So I tell him everything. It ends up taking 30 minutes and 2 cups of coffee each. That's quite the tale, he whistles. One break and enter, contributing to the delinquency of a minor, another break and enter, theft under on both B and E, and 9 million at stake. You're looking at a combined sentence of 16 years to life. Are you sure it's worth it? Really, is all I can mutter. The law doesn't fuck around, Jess. Now, the fact that everybody in town seems to know about this and is doing stuff means you're unlikely to be punished, even if you get noticed. We can't put an entire village on trial as contributing accessories after the fact. That would be insane. My advice to you, as your lawyer, is to forget this whole thing and deny all knowledge of what you've told me. 9 million is a lot, but it's not worth your freedom. Are you going to do that? No, I admit. It's good advice, Fig, but this is my dad's legacy. I don't want a bunch of yahoos ripping up his history trying to get rich. In that case, I suggest you hire some muscle to protect you if need be, he replies. Do you know anybody? I ask. As a matter of fact, I do. I'll bring him over this afternoon. He'll be here at 2 o'clock, Fig says. Why so late in the day? I ask. I've got to pick him up from prison. Today he gets released. Fig smiles as he sips the last of his coffee. It's a long day with a constant watch of treasure hunters across the street. I'm not sure what they think will happen, but it's annoying. Around noon, I decide I can't take it anymore. I call the police. I have the sense to not call the emergency line, as nobody is getting hurt, but there is a non-emergency number. The phone rings, and eventually after a series of options, I get through to the city police force. Police, how can we help? A pleasant voice asks. There's people outside my house, I answer. Are they causing a disturbance? The voice asks. No, they're watching me, I answer. Watching you do what? The officer asks. Just watching me, I say. Miss, so there's people standing on your property watching you, the officer clarifies. No, they're across the road, watching my house in case I leave. I reply. How many people? The officer asks. About 3, but they have a shift rotation so I'm under constant surveillance, I answer. What are they doing right now? There is the sound of typing in the background as the officer takes the report. They're talking, I answer the question. How long have they been there? The officer asks. About 2 hours, I answer. If I understand you, there are a couple of people having a conversation across from your house, the officer summarizes. That's right. I'd like it to stop, I say. There's no law against that, ma'am. Have a nice day. They hang up. I consider calling back to mention there's $9 million on the line, but decide that would only make matters worse. Figaro was right. I don't want to go to prison for 16 years. 2 o'clock comes and goes. By 2:30, I'm starting to worry, and then Figaro's car rolls into the driveway. Two men get out, Figaro and what looks like the biggest dude I have ever seen. He's at least 6.5 feet tall, very wide at the shoulders, and ripped with so much muscle he lacks a neck or the ability to fold his arms across his chest. They come up to the door, which I open reluctantly. This is an ex-con who could snap me in two with his pinky. Jessica Silver, this is Brian Brule, Figaro introduces us. Brian looks at the floor, clearly embarrassed about something. He's dressed in a gray tracksuit that looks a size too small. Pleased to meet you, I say. I tentatively hold out a hand to shake. He looks up and smiles. It's a heartwarming smile. There are crinkles around his eyes from a lifetime of laughing. This is no young thug, which I originally thought because he is so fit. His face can't hide the fact that he's at least 15 years older than me. Pleased to meet you too, he whispers. We move into the living room. Brian is shy, Figaro says. Don't let that fool you. Once he warms up, he doesn't stop talking. He'll make an excellent guard for you, but we're relying on his appearance to do most of the work. Why, I ask. I don't like to hurt people, Brian answers in a quiet voice. Brian happens to have a black belt in martial arts, Figaro continues. Ninjutsu, Brian adds. You're a full-fledged ninja, I ask. They call me Brawl, he nods. Chet is going to love this, I laugh. Who is Chet? Is he the one causing you problems? Brian asks. Chet is constantly causing problems, I admit. He's my son. He tends to be energetic and enthusiastic, but the real problem is the jerks across the road. Can you make them leave? No, Brian answers. They're not doing anything illegal or hurting anyone. They're just talking. They have to be committing a crime against your person before I can do anything. Otherwise, I'll go back to prison. This is a delicate question, I start, but why were you in jail? It's none of my business, of course, but I'll need to explain your presence to my family. I was jumped by a gang of hoodlums and defended myself a little too well, Brian answers. He was swarmed and fought back using lethal force, Figaro explains. You killed somebody, I clarify. It was 30-on-1, Figaro says. You killed 30 people, I'm shocked, yet impressed at the same time. I killed 2 and beat up 28, Brian corrects. In a fight like I was in, there's no time for submission holds. They were hurting people and I had to stop them. They were beating up a young man and his girlfriend when Brian came upon the scene, Figaro says. Brian stepped in as a good Samaritan and things got ugly really fast. They were going to kill him and rape her so she would learn a lesson, Brian said. That's what the mob was saying they were going to do. It was a black man and a white woman, Fig said. So you beat up 30 white supremacists and killed 2 of them, I asked. Yeah, Brian admits. Do you want a sandwich and a beer? His stomach growls at the mention of food. Yes, please, ma'am. He hangs his head. It's Jessica. I'll need to know where you're staying so I can reach you. I move into the adjacent kitchen and start to assemble some meatloaf from the other night into sandwiches. The loaf passes the sniff test. I'm not really sure what day I made it originally. About that, Jess, Figaro starts. I thought I was staying here, Brian startles. You have a guest room, right? Fig continues. You want a superhero ninja who beats up racists staying at my house, I ask. Yeah, Figaro answers. It would be an honor, I say. Gentlemen, Please come to the kitchen table. Wash your hands. We have a feast of meatloaf sandwiches and cut vegetables that are always in the fridge for a healthy snack. Brian doesn't say much, but does smile a lot. I get the feeling he's a good guy, and I know Figaro wouldn't recommend anyone dangerous to me. Figaro leaves shortly after the late lunch. I'm deciding how to spin this to Peter when his car rolls into the driveway. The kids bound into the house while Peter follows with Bree in her car seat. There's a torrent of noise until they come into the kitchen and see Brian. Brian stands up to be introduced. The kids stand there with gaping mouths and Peter isn't much better. Hello, Peter recovers first. Hi, I answer. Peter, kids, this is Brian, our new groundskeeper and handyman. He just got out of prison for beating up racists and saving a couple's lives. He's going to stay in the guest room for a while. He's also a super ninja. Hello, Mr. Silver. Brian holds out his hand. It looks like Bree holding my hand, only it's Peter and Brian. Brian's hands are easily 4 times larger than Peter's. They shake. They don't do that macho thing where they try to hurt each other. Peter knows he's outmuscled, and Brian wouldn't do that anyway. You're a ninja, Chet recovers next. Brian nods. Do something ninja-like, Ariel suggests. Brian drops into a combat pose in the middle of the kitchen and then goes through a kata at record speed. His limbs are a flash as he moves so quick it's hard to keep track of where he actually is. It's really impressive and somewhat frightening. Wow, is all any of us managed to say 30 seconds later. He stands and bows to us, but mostly to Peter. Brian knows who has to be convinced. Groundskeeper and handyman, Peter checks with me. Bodyguard, but that sounds a little over the top, I say. Figaro had to intervene today when some treasure hunters decided to muscle me. He suggested Brian hang out with us in case it happens again. How much do you know? Peter asks Brian. I've got a high school education that I completed in prison, Brian answers. About your situation, I know that you're after buried treasure from Mrs. Silver's father, and the whole town is trying to jump your claim. Figaro told me that, but in complete disclosure, I'm not interested in your money. I just don't want to go back to prison. I need a job. I'll cut your lawn and clean your house and protect you to the best of my ability. And you think a bodyguard is necessary? Peter asks me. Figaro thinks so, and I trust his opinion, I answer. If he hadn't stopped by when he did, the situation could have gotten ugly. Really ugly. All right, Peter sighs. I'm not happy about needing protection, but if Fig says you're okay, I'll believe it until proven wrong. Have you discussed payment and living arrangements? I'm working for room and board, Brian replies. Plus, a small stipend, I add. I'm going to be between jobs, Peter reminds me. And after the summer I go back to the office, I answer. I also expect this whole thing will be over by Sunday when we go to get the treasure. Once the money is in the bank, there's nothing to be done about it. Will you teach me ninjutsu? Chet pipes up. Brian looks up at me. I nod my head ever so slightly. Yes, Brian answers Chet, who is oblivious to the whole approval process. Here's your first lesson. Don't fight unless you have to. Fighting should be the last resort when talking or running away fails. You want me to run from a fight? Chet asks. Won't people call me a chicken? What's wrong with being a chicken? Chickens are among the fastest land birds there are. Have you ever tried to catch one? They are agile and nimble after a fashion. They're not bright and are relatively docile, but if cornered, they will fight. That's what I want you to be, a cornered chicken. If you decide to fight when there are other options available, I will not be able to teach you. I will refuse to teach you. Okay, Chet grumbles. I won't fight unless I have to. That also means not starting any fights just to have no options, Brian adds. Man, what's the point of being a ninja if I can't fight? Chet complains. A true ninja rarely fights, Brian explains. He practices so that when a fight happens, he is ready, but nobody in their right mind attacks a ninja in the first place. Let me show you the guest room, Peter suggests. Do you have much baggage?
I'm wearing everything I own, Brian replies. Figaro lent me some money to get some more clothes.
I guess it's time for a shopping trip, I announce.
That'll be a problem, Jess, Peter says. Six people, and the car seats five.
I'll take Brian and Chet to the store, I decide. You, Ariel, and Bree stay here.
Why do I have to stay? Ariel asks.
Your dad will be lonely without anybody to keep him company, and Chet, I look at my son who is trying to do the kata Brian did and completely ignoring everything else in the room.
Chet is Chet, I whisper to Ariel. She nods and gives me a hug. We'll do the groceries while we're there.
I grab the list from the fridge. 5 minutes later, we're in the car being followed by treasure vigilantes. I'm about to accelerate through a yellow light to lose them when Brian, in the front passenger seat, tells me otherwise. If they follow you to ordinary places and see you doing ordinary things, then they'll get bored and stop, Brian explains. If you try to lose them, they'll think you're up to something and try harder. We shop with a growing entourage who stay a polite distance from us. There end up being a dozen treasure hunters circulating around us in groups muttering and generally making a nuisance of themselves. I've got a large cart full of food and clothes for Brian. There is so much stuff piled in the cart and dangerously mounding over the top. This is not going to be a self-serve checkout or express lane cart. We're headed to the cashier lines. There are 15 of them in the megastore. Three are open. There are carts lined up five deep.
Would it kill them to open more caches? Brian asks. How long were you away? I reply.
25 years. Things have changed a lot, he says.
Well, this is the way things happen now, I say.
Why? He asks.
Nobody knows, but someone thought it would be a great idea to empower shoppers by making self-service the preferred method. They reduce staff, and now there aren't enough employees for customer service.
How does that make customers happy? Brian asks.
They're not in the business of making customers happy, I answer.
Eventually, we get through to be next in line. The cashier looks up and sees our massive load of supplies and starts to reach for the brake sign. I catch her eye. Both of us narrow our vision.
I'll put that up for you, Brian suggests as he plucks the sign and puts it behind us. There's a groan from the shopper behind us.
Are you kidding me? The shopper demands.
Sorry, Brian replies with all sincerity. The woman is going to need a break, and at minimum wage, those are like diamonds. The man behind us starts to rant and rage, and I know this is going to turn into a bad scene. At the same time, I don't want to give up my spot in line or move somewhere else. It took 20 minutes to get into the pay position. The cashier starts to scan our items while the infuriated customer tries to shoulder his way into the lane.
Hey, is all I manage to say as he tries to shove me out of the way. The cashier is looking worried and is frantically calling a number on her phone. There is no cause for concern because the enraged shopper is lying on the ground whimpering with Brian holding a point on his hand between the thumb and forefinger.
You will not touch this or any other lady in a rude fashion ever again, Brian orders.
You're breaking my arm, the man complains.
It's a finger lock, Brian explains. Your arm will be fine, and there will be no permanent damage.
I suggest you find another aisle to wait in. Brian lets the man go.
The shopper jumps to his feet and throws a punch at Brian's head. Brian's hand, as large as a dinner plate, envelopes the other man's fist and stops it dead in the air, inches from hitting. Sweat appears on the shopper's forehead as security come from some back room.
What's the problem? The guard swaggers up to the fray.
No problem, Brian looks at the guard, and then drops the fist.
We were having a difference of opinion.
Nothing else. Brian looks at the shopper.
Yeah, The man answers. I slipped, and he caught me from falling. By the fist, the guard looks skeptical. If it was anything else, there would be questions and paperwork, Brian says. Nobody wants that, do they?
No, the guard, man, and cashier all agree. Fighting a mountain of a man doesn't seem to faze the angry customer, but a form to fill out does. He takes his stuff and moves to another cash line. All the time Chet just observes, twitching like a race horse at the gate, but learning the art of non-aggression. $600 later, and a trunk full of stuff, mostly Brian's, we motor back home. Brian unloads all the bags and starts to put things away in the kitchen without being asked. That has never happened before. Even with Peter, I have to ask twice to get help unpacking groceries. After half an hour, there's nothing left to put away, but there's a large pile of food on the counter. Brian has made it his mission to know where everything goes without asking obvious questions. The pile of food and canned goods is impressive. What's that? I point to the pile as Brian roots under the kitchen sink. All the food you have to throw out because it's expired, Brian answers as he pulls out a garbage bag. All that, I gasp. Brian holds up a can of chickpeas. 3 years ago, he says. It's a shame. I make a great hummus, but your tahini expired 5 years ago. I meant to make homemade hummus about 5 years ago, but never got around to it. I get that one, but those wraps I just bought last week. Brian picks up the package and knocks it against the counter. It sounds like rock smashing wood. These expired 2 months ago. About tomorrow, Peter walks into the discussion, looks at the waste food, and then continues. Can I get a rain check on church? George got us an earlier tea time at a better course. I'd like to go, but I know how much church means to you. You can play golf, I answer, and then look to see where the children are. Going to church doesn't mean that much to me. I'm just trying to think of a tactful way of getting out of it without cheesing the kids. Bait and switch, Brian suggests. What, Peter and I ask. You'll be followed into the church by the treasure seekers. Take the kids to the bathroom and I'll meet you in your car by the emergency exit. I doubt it's got an alarm on it. They probably rely on honesty if it's an older church. You get in the car with the kids and we'll be away. That should buy at least 15 minutes before anybody realizes something is amiss. I like it, Peter replies. You like it because it means you don't have to go to church, I correct. It can be two things, he says. Agreed. Let's do that, I say. But at this point, let's not involve the kids in the planning. Chapter 5, Church and Farm. Sunday dawns like lead poured over Peter. Nobody wants to get up as the sky threatens rain. It's not going to rain. It's just going to threaten rain all day as dark gray clouds wander around the sky and occasionally spit a few drops. Overcast in that way that only depressed goths like, with no hint of a finale. It's the perfect day to go to church. Do we have to? Chet asks again for about the eighth time this morning. I'm wearing a beige dress that I found in the back of the closet. Ariel is in a sundress, and Chet has on a pair of slacks and his only good shirt. Yes, I answer. Bree doesn't have to go, Chet says. Bree is a baby, I answer. She's without sin. She doesn't need church yet, and she would be in the way. Golfing with my daughter, Peter comes into the kitchen wearing a ridiculous outfit of garish shorts, a golf shirt, and a hat. Worse, somehow he managed to find the matching outfit for Bree. She is holding a teether shaped like a golf club. Where did you get those outfits? I ask. Pro shop, Peter replies. I'm not the only glad dad to bring my baby to the course. The world is changing, Jess. Golf is a family sport now. Pass, I say. If I dress like a clown, can I go golfing with dad? Chet asks. I need you with me, I answer.
Why? Chet asks. I might need a distraction, I say. Oh, Chet catches on. Church is a sleight of hand thing. We're letting people see what we want them to see.
No, church is real. We just won't be staying for the entire thing.
I kiss Peter on the cheek as I gather up my two kids. Go kill a birdie, I kiss him a second time.
It's shoot a birdie, Jess, he answers with a dopey smile.
Brian is already in the driver's seat with the car running. We pile into the car. Where to? Brian asks. Other side of town, I reply.
It's a big church. It'll be hard to miss.
Sit in the very back row, Brian offers as we start off, followed by a couple of cars full of treasure hunters. They'll have to sit in front of you and look behind themselves to see where you are. That's uncomfortable and looks bad in church, so they're less likely to do it. That gives you an opportunity to evade detection. How do you know that? Chet asks.
Ninja, Brian answers.
Right. Operate in the darkness, Chet smiles. That's a common misbelief, Brian says. Ninjas don't need darkness to avoid detection. It just makes it easier. We roll up to the church a few minutes later. Richmond is growing, but the core of the village is not that big. There's a couple of family restaurants, a couple of pizza parlors, and rumor has it that the big hole in the ground near the grocery store is going to be a fast food joint. I don't believe it, but I never thought I would see my village grow the way it is. There are developments popping up all around the perimeter of the hamlet. It used to be Richmond was a place to go quietly to pieces during retirement or live for cheap outside the big city. Now we have our own women's softball league. I should look into that. I like the idea of softball, but don't know if I would be any good. I'll pick you up after church, Brian startles me out of my musings.
15 minutes, I mutter so only he can hear.
That's right, he nods for the benefit of the vigilantes. About 90 minutes. Chet, Ariel, and I get out of the car. Brian pulls away while claim jumpers pile out of cars to follow us into the church. Jessica, the priest meets us at the door as we go in.
It's good to see you.
I was hoping we would meet under more pleasant terms than burying a loved one.
You have my condolences, dear.
Your father was quite the character.
He was, I agree.
Sit anywhere you want, dear. It's good you've come back to the fold. We get into the back row near the far end of a pew. The rest of the bench is already full, and we get lucky. There's a door which leads to the hall off the church, if I remember correctly, so we can escape to the bathroom, and then out the back door. Father Murdoch gets up, starts to deliver the sermon, and I'm immediately reminded why I stopped going to church.
It's not that it's boring. It's exhausting. Kneel, sit, kneel, stand, sit, kneel, stand, kneel, sit, and then stand, and so on.
I nudge Ariel, who catches Chet's attention. We slip out of the pew and through the side door. We manage to make it to the exit by the washrooms when somebody shouts from behind us, "Going somewhere, Mrs. Silver." I turn around to see the rude treasure hunter that pushed me the other day. "We're going to the family bathroom," I point to the door as I reach for the handle.
"That's for families with young kids," he says.
"What's it to you if we all want to piss together? You want to guard the door. Be my guest. It's a bluff, but a good one, I think." I will do just that. He leans against the wall. We go into the family bathroom. There's a window. Fortune is smiling on us. I nod to the window. Chet opens it and is out in a second, like a spider monkey.
"Mom, dress." Ariel points at her clothes.
"I'll help you." I lift her to the window and then slide her out so Chet can catch her. "Are you okay in there, Jessica?" The rude hunter knocks on the door. "I'm dropping a loaf," I shout back. "Give us some privacy, jerk." The doorknob rattles a little. I climb onto the radiator below the window and stick my legs out, and then I'm stuck.
I wasn't so worried about Ariel's dignity going through a window in a dress, but I have a bit more concern about myself. I turn around with great difficulty and try to drop the few feet to the ground. I can't feel the ground and am starting to panic. Suddenly, strong hands grab me about the waist. I scream. "Are you okay?" There's a note of concern in the jerk's voice through the bathroom door. "It's me. I'm here to help," Brian whispers behind me as he lifts me off the sill. "It's an epic coil," I shout at the seeker. "Leave us alone for a few minutes. Maybe light a candle." I'm on the ground and making for the car. We get in and are away to Saunders Farm. "So church was a clever ruse," Chet laughs in the back seat. "No," I answer. "We'll have to repent for this." Saunders Farm is only 15 minutes away. It's a tourist attraction that boasts mazes, seasonal activities, jumping pillows, splash pads, and other family-friendly activities. It's the kind of place that regularly updates their activities, so from season to season there is always something different that makes it worthwhile. We usually go a couple of times in the summer. This time, however, we're on a mission. I've never been good with maps. I can read them, and I understand that there's a method to the madness of cartographers. I just don't get the way something flat on a small paper can help find where we're going once we get into the parking lot of Saunders Farm. Brian isn't much more help, but thankfully a glint of silver catches my eye. It's a wheelchair, and the man in it knows how to read a map. "Sergeant Matters," I shout as I hop out of the car. The wheelchair stops and the man in it looks toward me. My heart skips a beat. Jonathan Matters is without a doubt the most beautiful man any woman has ever seen. He's carved from marble, with so many scars that the web of violence over his body has its own unique beauty. He smiles, and the parking lot goes dim out of respect for his brilliance. He'd be over 6 feet tall if he had legs, but he's only a torso with arms, a landmine in Afghanistan having deprived him of his legs. "Jessica," he says in his butter-melting voice. "It's nice to see you." Brian and the kids come forward. "Hey, Ariel, Chet, mysterious stranger who isn't Peter." "This is Brian Brule. He's a friend of the family," I introduce. "He's a ninja," Chet boasts. "He's teaching me to be liquid death." "Cool," Jonathan replies. "Can you help me read this map?" I ask. "I'll catch up," Jonathan shouts to a woman who is waiting patiently with a couple of kids. "Am I interrupting a date?" I ask. "Play date," Jonathan answers. "My sister with her kids. They want me out of the house more, because I don't have enough going on. Let's see the map." I hand him the printout of the treasure map. It's a topographic map. It's pretty much useless unless you know where it's showing or have a point of reference. "It's here at Saunders Farm," I explain. "Okay. You want to find this X-marked spot?" Jonathan asks. "Yes, please." Sergeant Matters pulls out one of the site maps for the farm that shows all the games, rides, and mazes. "This is just a guess based on what I know of the land from being here before, because there's no scale on this tourist map. I think whatever that X is, you'll find in Cemetery Stroll." "Thank you," I give him a hug and a kiss on the cheek. He cops a quick feel of my ass. Brian looks like he's about to say something, but I subtly shake my head as I stand back up. "Enjoy your day," I tell Sergeant Jonathan Matters. Jonathan rolls away to catch up to his sister, his arms pumping the wheels like a juggernaut across a field of battle. Nothing ever stops Jonathan Matters. "He touched you," Brian starts. "It's an inside joke," I reply. "There's no insult intended. Now, let's get inside before claim jumpers find us. I know that Cemetery Stroll is currently closed. That's a Halloween event." "What you need," Chet paused for dramatic effect, "is a distraction." "What do you have?" I ask. "It's best you don't know, but I have a ninja and a little sister. I think I'll be covered no matter what I do." "All right. I'll pay our fees to get in and then we'll see. I pay for our entrance. We get inside the gate and then move a short way into the park. I need to get into that area over there. I point to the area closed off by a barricade. There doesn't seem to be any security in that area, so if you can create a distraction over by the bouncing pillows to draw people away from here, it would help me greatly. Give us 10 minutes, Chet orders. I have no idea what he has planned, but maybe it's better that I don't know. I wander over to the area in front of Cemetery Stroll. I pretend to be looking at the plants and trees. About 10 minutes later, I see a bunch of people go running off toward the mazes. I slip around the barricade and then over to the Halloween experience. There's a wide, though muddy path that I follow into the graveyard. I start looking around and realize it's pretty much hopeless. I look around the cemetery for anything that looks like a combination lock. There's nothing there. I sit on a bench and get ready for a sulk. "What were you thinking, Dad?" I ask out loud. A crow lands on one of tombstones and caws. I look up and see on the tombstone the inscription, "Here lies Ryan Silver. He died in the wood chipper." I know for a fact that my dad didn't die in a wood chipper, and he was probably hired to do work at the farm. He was a popular handyman. I root around at the base of the tombstone. There's something hard just beneath the surface, so I dig. It's a cement box with a combination lock set in it. I take out the second clue and start spinning the numbers for the combination. It takes a few tries because the lock is covered in dirt and hasn't been used in a long time. Eventually, I get it open and the door panel lifts up on a hinge. I reach inside. There's an envelope that is quite thick. I stuff it in my purse and then cover the hole I made. "Excuse me, miss, you shouldn't be here," a voice says behind me. I turn around to find a Saunders Farm employee walking up to me. "I got lost," I say. "Yeah, that happens." He points to a tractor hauling a wagon full of hay. "Do you want to ride out? It's a little messy around here right now. It's full of mud." "Yes, please." I look at my shoes. They're ruined. "You'll have to ride on the hay," he says as he helps me into the wagon. He starts the tractor and we trundle away around the long way out of Cemetery Stroll. I move to the front of the hay wagon so I can talk to the driver. "How long until we get back?" I ask. "Miss, you shouldn't be at the front because too late." The tractor goes over a bump into a puddle and a spray of mud sloshes up between the tractor and the wagon. I get sprayed head to foot in wet goo. My shoes are ruined. My beige dress is ruined. My hair is a mess and my face is covered in mud. "Sorry," the driver smirks as my dress clings to my body. We get back to the main part of the farm. I see an employee near the entrance escorting Chet and Ariel to the admission building. Brian is walking a discreet distance behind, making sure they're okay but not getting involved. "I'll take those off your hands," I say to the employee. "They're my kids. Did they misbehave?" "They were being unruly," the employee says. "All right, children," I use my scolding voice. "We're going to go home and you'll do chores all day long. This will be the last time you misbehave in public. Let's go."
"Miss, there's a procedure," the employee starts to say.
"I'll take care of disciplining them," I answer as I grab each of my kids by a shoulder and start to drag them to the parking lot. "What happened to you?" Ariel asks.
"Mud.
It's a long story, but I got what we came for. Brian meets us at the car and then we get in. Brian drives. Let's go home. I need to clean up." Chapter 6, The Third Clue. I'm cleaned up and the four of us are seated around the living room with a thick envelope on the coffee table. Peter should be home soon, so I want to wait to open the package of bonds.
"Open it," Chet suggests.
"Yeah," Ariel agrees.
"Do you have an opinion?" I ask Brian. "It's your treasure and envelope," he replies. "I'm the handyman and gardener."
A car pulls into the driveway. There's the slamming of doors and then the jingle of keys in the front door. Peter comes in with Bree in her car seat.
She's sound asleep.
Just in time, I call.
Your mission was successful. Peter leans over to kiss my cheek and at the same time pulls a twig I missed out of my hair.
Right there, I point at the envelope. It's a thick manila envelope that looks dingy and dirty. The compartment it was in was secure from the elements for the most part, but a little wear and tear happened regardless of my father's intentions.
Go for it, Peter suggests. I rip open the envelope. Out slides a thick package which I recognize as a map. It's a map of the Richmond area from over 30 years ago. Off the south edge of the map is a handwritten note, "Here be treasure," and there are a bunch of numbers. There's a loud clunk as a ring of keys and a locket on a necklace falls on the table. The locket is shaped like a small golden key and inscribed with a short message, "I love you, Clarice." Those are coordinates for a geocache. Ariel looks at the numbers. Minutes and seconds in latitude and longitude. We can use my phone to find it. We learned this at school.
Do we go right now? Peter asks. We're still one body too many for the car.
I have to go to use my phone, Ariel says.
I'm not sitting this out, Peter adds.
I have to go, and we need Brian in case there's claim jumpers, I say as I pick up the locket. I put it around my neck. My father was never one to say he loved us out loud, but he did show it in his actions.
We can't leave Bree without a sitter, Peter says. We all turn to look at Chet. Chet looks back at us, puts the math together, and then panics.
You might need a distraction, Chet says with a quaver. I am the master of distraction, and I can't be trusted to be left alone. I might burn the house down or sell it to somebody. We could buy a minivan, and then we could all go.
We could use a minivan, Ariel agrees.
We're not buying a minivan on Sunday, I reply. But it's not a bad idea for the future.
We could paint it orange and green and go around solving mysteries and fighting crime, Chet suggests.
You're not helping the argument, Peter says.
Chet, I know you want to go on this, but it isn't possible, I start.
If you don't take me, you'll regret it, Chet threatens.
No, you're more than old enough to stay at home by yourself for a few hours. If we get home and there's anything wrong, any damage or trouble, you'll regret it.
I poke a finger in his chest for emphasis. I'm tired of getting calls from the school about you. I'm tired of being embarrassed by your behavior. You will shape up right now or no more ninjutsu or magic for you.
That's not fair, Chet wails.
Chet, Brian snaps his fingers, a little like a dog trainer, but it works. A true ninja is master of their emotions and body. It's time for your second lesson. While we are gone, I want you to sit here, he points to the couch, and listen to the sound of your own heartbeat. Try to slow it down as much as you can.
What if I slow it so much that I die? Chet asks.
You won't be able to do that yet.
If you can get your heart down to 40 beats a minute, I'll be super impressed, Brian says.
Okay, he jumps onto the couch.
Do not leave that spot for any reason, Brian cautions.
What if I have to pee? Chet asks.
A true ninja would hold it, but if you have to go, you have to go, Brian answers.
That's settled, we take a moment to change Bree and get organized. Ariel activates the geocache compass on her phone, and then we pile into the car. Bree gets middle back, flanked on either side by Ariel and Peter. Brian is riding shotgun because he's not likely to fit in the back.
We pull out of the driveway and are immediately followed by three cars of claim jumpers. I coast up to the stop sign at the end of our crescent and stop. There's a delivery truck coming down the road. They have the right of way, but at the last possible second I gun the accelerator and make a wide left. The first claim jumper roars after us and there is the screech of metal chewing through metal. Looking in the rearview mirror, I see the collision has totally blocked off the intersection. The rest of the claim jumpers will have to turn around and go out the other end of the crescent. We'll be long gone by then.
That was dangerous, Brian remarks while Peter's white knuckles unwrap from the hand grip in the back door. We make a few turns and then are on Malakoff Road headed south.
We need to go south for about 10 miles past town and then turn west.
There's a trail marked on the map, Ariel navigates. We drive, alone without any claim jumpers in sight. The sky is starting to darken with a coming storm, and I'm thinking of bailing when Ariel shouts, "Turn here."
I will ride into a driveway, but there's a wall of foliage in front of me. Keep going.
There's no road, I say to my insistent child.
Grandpa wouldn't send us on a wild goose chase, Ariel replies. I look at Peter.
Pedal to the metal, Peter wraps his hand around the grip and leans over Bree.
I stomp the accelerator, and we charge forward through about 5 feet of light vines and leaves. Then we're on an old farm lane that heads west. It's seen better days, and I have doubts my sedan is going to make it.
Allow me, Brian gets out and walks in front of the car.
I turn on the headlights so I can see him. He sets out at a quick walk that would leave me sweating. He points out deep ruts and wheel-wrenching potholes.
I drive around them with his help. It seems to take forever, but after about half an hour at a snail's pace, we come to a bomb shelter.
There's no other way to describe it.
There's a dense-looking concrete mound with a steel door and a dozen padlocks. There are chains padlocked to the steel doors with iron bars padlocked to the chains. It looks like my dad wanted to make sure nobody could get in without a great deal of difficulty. The hinges swing inward, so there's no possibility of grave robbers.
I guess we start trying out keys, I say as I pull out the full key ring.
No need. Brian walks out from around the mound. A tree grew into the side, bust the wall open, and then fell over.
There's a gap big enough to get through in the back. We go to look at the hole.
It's a dark pit beyond the gaping maw. Worse, however, is the rope tied to the stump and dangling into the darkness. Someone is down there, I mutter.
It could be an old rope, Peter suggests. Only way to find out is to go down, Brian adds.
At that moment, an inhuman scream sounds from deep within the tomb.
You first, I say to Brian. We'll need light, Brian says. Cell phone, Ariel says as she pops the app, and light splays out of the camera flash.
Climbing down a rope is fairly easy, Peter says. Have we given much, though, on how we're going to get out?
Take these and open the door. I hand Peter the key ring.
Ready, Brian asks as he's climbing into the hole.
He starts to shimmy down the rope.
I go next, and then Ariel. Brian is like a monkey. Climbing down a rope isn't as easy as it looks in the movies. I slide down, burning my hands, and collide with Brian's shoulders. I'm sitting on his shoulders with my heels kicking his back.
Not that I mind. Brian's muffled voice comes from between my thighs, but could you 180? I can handle the weight, but it's a little distracting.
Sorry, I scuttle around his shoulders and get to ride to the bottom in comfort. Ariel has no problem with the rope. It's something they do in gym class all the time. At the bottom of the rope, maybe 50 feet, we're in a short passage. There are a lot of spider webs and some broken branches. I start to squeal at a spider crawling up my leg, but Brian puts a hand over my mouth.
There is only a sliver of light coming through the entrance above, and that is fading with coming the storm.
Movement ahead, he whispers as he hands me a branch. This is a club for you. He takes another branch and then takes off his t-shirt. He wraps the shirt around the branch and then gathers spider webs around the shirt. He lights the whole mess on fire with a lighter. Using his torch, which is burning fast and smoky, we move ahead. We're at the base of a long staircase leading up. We can barely make out a steel door at the top of the stairs. That was how we were supposed to come in. Leading away from the stairs is a narrow hallway with old electric lights hanging from the ceiling. Brian leads, Ariel and I follow. I can barely see around Brian's back as we walk single file. My hands tighten around my club, ready to use it against who knows what. The passage expands until we're standing in a small room. Against the far wall is another steel door. Standing between the door and us, carrying a heavy flashlight, is the last person I expected to see. Chapter 7, The Trove. It's Bigfoot, Ariel cries. Chet was right. There's a man, wearing cut-off shorts and running shoes, and nothing else except for a fine layer of fur all over his body. Bigfoot, he looks more like a werewolf to me. Then I think, oh my god. We have to fight a werewolf. He has fur everywhere, except his eyelids, which he blinks slowly in the torchlight to clear his vision from firelight. Hey, Bigfoot says. Brian looks at me. Apparently, I'm the spokesperson. Hi, I manage. Please don't bite us. I'm not a werewolf, he glances at Ariel. Or Bigfoot. I've got a genetic disorder called hypertrichosis. You can look it up. Ariel punches a few commands into her phone and then shows me the browser results. Werewolf disorder, I read. But I'm not a werewolf. I just look like one. There's a deep rumbling noise, and then all the overhead lighting snaps on. A few minutes later, Peter is strolling toward us with Bree in her snuggly. What did I miss? Peter asks. How did you turn on the lights? I ask. Light switch at the top of the stairs. There was an old propane generator in a nook. Quite frankly, I'm surprised I could get it going, but your dad knew how to maintain things for the long haul. Your dad, the werewolf points at me. You're Jessica. Jessica Silver, he walks toward me with his hand extended. Yes, I answer. Pleased to meet you. I shake his hand. Please don't bite me. I'm not a werewolf, he says again. My name is Steve Aiden. Your father bought $1,000 in stock from me every year between 1980 and 1995. I heard about his death. I came to find the stock because he never offloaded any of it. I don't have a key for this door. Do you? My dad bought $1,000 of Apple stocks, I mutter. Jess, do you have the letter on you? Peter asks. I fish it out of my purse. He reads it in the glow of electric light. This says stock, not stocks or bonds. I don't think this is Apple computers. Then what is it? I look at the lock. It'll take a small, delicate key. I take off the necklace and look at the pendant my dad meant for my mom. I put it in the lock and give it a turn. There's a satisfying click of the mechanism. Brian pulls on the heavy door to reveal a large room crammed full of sex toys, Steve explains. We like to call them adult novelties in the trade, but they're sex toys. Made them in China for a couple of dollars each, shipped over here, and then sold for 10 times the production cost. All these are mint. Lifetime guarantee, so they should be in good working order. Garden of Eden, I read one of the boxes, apple of my thigh adult massager. So you're Steve Aiden, sex toy mogul, not Steve Jobs. I'm Steve Aiden, defunct sex toy mogul trying to get a leg back in the business. This is about 10,000 units of stock. And I suppose it belongs to you now. He looks totally defeated, and there is nothing sadder than a beaten werewolf. What does it do? Ariel looks at the box in my hand. How do I break this to my daughter without seeming perverted or giving her too much knowledge that could be tarnished back to my already shaky reputation? It makes an adult feel good by stimulating their genitalia, Steve offers. So it's a vibrator, Ariel clarifies. A high-quality vibrator, Steve corrects. What do you know about vibrators? I ask her. Mom, she rolls her eyes. You sign me up for sex ed classes, and I've got unlimited internet. I'm not a little kid anymore. What do we do now? Peter asks. I look around at my husband, daughter, a ninja, and a werewolf who are all looking at me for a decision, and a huge pile of dildos. I guess we open an online store, I finally say. I manage to get the car turned around in a 30-point turn on the narrow trail. Brian walks us out after we lock the trove back up. I'll send Brian back for Steve once we get home, but I also realize Chet has been alone far too long. We get home to see a half dozen police cars outside the house with lights on and a bunch of men being led out of the house. One of them is struggling with the police. I recognize him as the leader of the treasure vigilantes. It's her fault. He points at me. There's a renewed struggle, and then the claim jumper comes out of the pile with a police pistol. Things are set in motion quickly. Out of the corner of my eye, I see Brian moving, there's a bark of the pistol, and Brian's arm flings out and wheels him around like a tornado. The police tackle the lead claim jumper, and Brian is standing, bouncing something in his palm. "This is hot," Brian says as he hands me a bullet. "You caught a bullet," Chet gasps from the front door. "Chet!" I scream as I rush to make sure he's okay. "Mom," he tries to shove his way out of a hug. "He caught a bullet. How cool is that?" "Ninja," Brian clears his throat. "What happened?" I ask. "Ma'am," a police sergeant walks up to me. "The boy was home alone when these men broke into the house. That's child neglect." "He's 12, I say. "He's old enough to stay home alone for a short time. What happened?" "These guys broke in the door," Chet says. "I beat them down, ninja style, and then hit the police call button on the alarm system while they were distracted." "Really?" I ask. "He punched the smallest man in the nads," the sergeant adds, "and while the rest of them were laughing, he pressed the button." "Ninja," Chet does a sloppy kata, but I couldn't be prouder. "We'll need statements about where you all were," the sergeant says. "You'll get them," I answer. "Right now, I need to hug my kids and send somebody to pick up a friend who is going to get wet. He tends to smell like a wet dog after the rain." About the author. John W. Partington is a Canadian writer living in Ottawa, Ontario. He was a soldier for 15 years in the Canadian Forces. After completing one tour of duty in Haiti, 1996, he suffered a bout of mental illness which resulted in a medical discharge from the Canadian Forces. Writing will always be his first love. His wife is his true love.